Welcome to America.
Right now, the American dream has turned into a nightmare.
We are African, and we happen to be in America. We're not American. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America. Our forefathers weren't the Pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us.
Welcome to America, the podcast that tells the true story of the United States, from the footsteps of the first colonists to the tragic fall of the Republic in the year 2024. Each week, we will read a chapter from the book by Rania Bint Mahdi, as translated from the Arabic, by me, Dylan Evans. Before we jump into today's episode, I want to take a moment to thank our lovely listeners. I'm really grateful to you for taking time to listen to Rania's version of US history. If you enjoy what you hear, there are a few ways you can support us and join the conversation. First off, make sure to hit that follow or subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. This way, you'll never miss an episode, and you'll always be the first to know when we drop new content. And we love hearing from you. Your reviews and feedback mean the world to us and help us improve the show. So take a quick moment to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're tuning in from. Tell us what you love, what you want more of, or even suggest topics that you'd like us to cover next. And hey, let's stay connected. Follow us on social media for behind-the-scenes content, sneak peeks of upcoming episodes, and maybe even some exclusive giveaways. You can find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Real America. Right, that's all for now. Let's dive into today's episode. Thank you for being a part of the America tribe. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. America by Rania Bint Mahdi, translated from the Arabic by Dylan Evans. Chapter 1, The First Colonies of the Ingles. According to legend, there was once a medicine man among the original inhabitants of America who saw the future of his people in a dream. On the eastern horizon he saw dark vessels filled with pale-faced men dressed in robes of purple and white. The pale faces slew the natives with swords of silver, and the rivers ran red with blood. In the place where the trees of America had once reached up to the heavens, the pale faces built a shining city on a hill. But the natives came back to haunt the children of the pale faces while they slept, and told them their city was just a dream. It was a dream within a dream, but it would become a global nightmare. Perhaps the dream still lives on underneath the shifting sands of the endless desert, but if so, I cannot hear its voice. All that remains of the Amrikiyun today is that great arm which rises from the earth and which I first saw when I was a girl of 12. As this legend makes clear, the Amrikiyun were not the original inhabitants of America. Rather, it seems they hailed from a small nation of pirates called Inglatira. When these buccaneers first arrived in America, they found that the natives, who had for many years lived simple and straightforward lives without much toil, had recently been enslaved by the Isban, whose beggarly pride and general filthiness had carried them over the ocean in search of gold. The sight of these noble savages being forced by the cruel Isban to spend their days toiling under the hot sun shocked the Ingles, who had always abhorred slavery and long prided themselves on being a body of free men with the right to trade freely in all kinds of merchandise, not excluding the human sort. The piratical Ingles therefore decided, out of the goodness of their hearts, to liberate the natives from the cruel bondage into which the Isban had plunged them, and thereby singe the beard of the Isbani king. In this noble venture they followed in the tradition of a long line of knights, who were wont in their time to advance the Christian faith against infidels and miscreants, and to seek honour by feats of arms. This act of piracy so delighted the Queen of Inglaterra that she commissioned her pirate-in-chief, Sir Walter Raleigh, to discover, search, find out and view such remote heathen and barbarous lands, countries and territories as he could discover in America, and to have, hold, occupy and enjoy them. By this means, Queen Elizabeth hoped that Raleigh would establish a base in the New World from which her lusty sea dogs could launch raids against the treasure fleets of Isbahan. Raleigh himself, however, was required to attend to the Queen in person every day, or as often as her appetite would permit, and so was forced to delegate the noble business of piracy to his associates, while he oversaw operations from the Queen's bedside. So successfully did Raleigh succeed in having, holding, occupying, and enjoying, and so delighted was the Queen in consequence of these feats, that he was granted a portion of land in America by the name of Virginia. The Queen thereby bestowed on Raleigh a title in recognition of that which he had taken away from her, and he became the Knight Lord and Governor of Virginia in more ways than one. Unfortunately, this first attempt to bring the blessings of Inglaterra to a heathen land did not meet with great success, and when a second expedition was sent to Virginia 5 years later, the crew could find no trace of the colonists, and their fate remains unknown to this day. But the Inglese would not let such a small setback deter them from pursuing their God-given mission, for they knew that Inglaterra needed more of the world, and the world needed Inglaterra, and a new expedition was dispatched. This time, the settlement proved somewhat more durable, despite a series of misfortunes. Named Jamestown after the King of Inglaterra, it was repeatedly attacked by unfriendly savages and beset by famine. It seems that the settlers chose to depend on the charity of the locals for their food rather than taking the trouble to plant any crops themselves, which strikes me as somewhat foolish given the mutual mistrust that existed between the newcomers and the natives. Indeed, far from courting the affection of the locals, the settlers often took pains to destroy them and their corn. The source of this foolishness may be found, perhaps, in the social composition of Jamestown, and in particular, the predominance of noblemen and gentry. Of the 105 settlers who started the colony, over a third were gentlemen, who included many unruly gallants packed thither by their friends to escape ill destinies at home, and who had no inclination to manual labour. The labourers were no more skilled at planting than the gentlemen, for they were mostly footmen who never did know what a day's work was. When a new governor arrived a few years later, he found the settlers amusing themselves by bowling in the streets and other pastimes. The next waves of Inglese to break against the shores of America were not, like the first, shady enterprises for private profit, but noble Mahajeroon seeking religious freedom. The colonies at Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay were both founded by bands of holy pilgrims who had made a hijra, like the Prophet and the Sahaba, to escape from religious persecution. But they were not Muslims, for scarcely any existed in Inglaterra at that time. They were, in fact, Christians, and, moreover, Christians of a very peculiar kind, a breakaway sect from a breakaway sect, which, in the noble tradition of Antifrasis for which the Amriciun would become rightly renowned, was called Albirutinia, or Puritanism, after its insistence on filtering out the last remaining vestiges of humanity from the Christian religion. Contrary to the commandment of the prophet Isa, whom they professed to follow, they rendered unto Allah what was owed to him, but refused to render unto Caesar what was owed to him. And history would show that they were not averse to killing kings. Puritanism was, in its turn, a breakaway sect from another breakaway sect, known as Protestantism, so-called because of an inveterate tendency to protest against everything that their forefathers had regarded as sacred and holy. From the moment of their first protest, which was made by certain German princes and representatives of free imperial cities at the Second Diet of Speyer, this tradition had been thoroughly contaminated by the spirit of insurrection. As we will see during the course of this narrative, this rebellious and turbulent spirit explains much about the history of America, from its very origins to its ultimate demise. The soul of America was, from its very inception, mutinous, and the most apt image of the Amerikyun is that of an old unruly she-camel who bites with her mouth, beats with her forelegs, kicks with her hind legs, and refuses to be milked. Nevertheless, it must be acknowledged that Puritanism gave these colonists a strong sense of asabiyya. As the Sheikh al-Islam Ibn Khaldun notes in Al-Muqaddimah, all societies begin with a strong sense of asabiyya among their members. This cohesion helps them overcome challenges, establishes a strong social order among them, and helps them to create a successful civilization. Only later, when a society reaches its peak of power, wealth, and influence, does prosperity lead to complacency, luxury, and a decline in the original strength of asabiyya. As we will see later, the history of America was no exception to this rule, for the Amerikyun would later lose their asabiyya, with all the inevitable consequences, internal strife, and vulnerability to external threats. But I'm getting ahead of myself. At this early stage in their history, the Amerikyun banded together to create strong communities, fight against common enemies, and establish the foundations of a new nation. The Puritan colonies at Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay were also possessed of what Ibn Khaldun calls the desert spirit, or the Bedouin mindset. They were self-reliant, adaptive to changing environments, and fiercely independent. Their ability to adapt to new environments, to innovate in the face of scarcity, and to build communities in such harsh conditions reflects the resilience of the desert spirit. They were courageous, willing to take risks and forge new paths. The Puritan principles of community responsibility and self-governance in these colonies emphasized unity and mutual support. Unlike the Jamestown colony, which was founded for economic profit and thus characterized by a more individualistic and competitive spirit, the colonies at Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay established more cooperative relations with the natives, which further strengthened community ties. There was no comparable sense of asabiyya in the Jamestown colony, where the focus on profit and the use of indentured servants and slavery led to a lack of community cohesion and more fragmented social dynamics. In essence, the purposes for which these colonies were founded, religious refuge versus economic profit, played a crucial role in shaping their social dynamics, governance structures, and sense of community cohesion. The colonies of Massachusetts Bay and Plymouth, with their shared religious values and cooperative efforts, exhibited a greater sense of asabiyya and unity compared to the more profit-driven and individualistic atmosphere of the Jamestown colony. Thus, within a few years of the settlers arriving in Massachusetts Bay, wrote one Puritan historian, a wilderness was subdued before them, and so many colonies planted, towns erected, and churches settled, wherein the true and living God in Christ Jesus is worshipped and served. The colonists settled at a town they named Salem, after a place mentioned in their holy book, and which some say is another name for Al-Quds. Their leader, a minister by the name of John Winthrop, had already announced his vision for the land they settled in a sermon titled A Model of Christian Charity, in which he portrayed the settlers as the new Jews, a chosen people called by Allah to establish a pure and righteous society. In their hijra from Inglaterra, they believed they were reenacting the exodus from Egypt, and the journey across the ocean was a form of divine providence, a hajj to create a new society free from the corruption of the old world. The Aborigines were their Canaanites, and they had a divine mandate to drive them out of the promised land. Like Salem, the settlements they built were named after places in their holy book, such as Bethlehem, Jericho, Hebron, and Bethel. In his sermon, Winthrop proclaimed his modest aspiration for the new community to become a model for the whole world to follow. "We shall find that the God of Israel is among us, when 10 of us shall be able to resist 1,000 of our enemies, when he shall make us a praise and glory that men shall say of succeeding generations, 'May the Lord make it like that of New England.' For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. So that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." He could not have foreseen it, but that phrase, "a city upon a hill," would mark the future of America forever after, for both good and ill. But the city would not always shine with the light of truth. It would also burn bright with the fire of fanaticism. For it was in this same town of Salem that some 6 decades after Winthrop first set foot there, a most terrible conflagration was ignited. But I'm getting ahead of myself once again. Before I tell the story of Salem, I should first say a few more words about the character of the colonies established by the settlers from Inglaterra. It appears that the colonists quickly demonstrated a penchant for rebellion against the authority of the king to whom they had sworn fealty. Their separatist beliefs and refusal to conform to the established norms of English society, which had led them to emigrate in the first place, laid the foundation for a culture of dissent and disrespect for even the most legitimate authority. As the colonies expanded, so too did the spirit of rebellion and ingratitude among the colonists. The New England colonies in particular, founded by Puritans like Winthrop, were in truth hotbeds of dissent and defiance. The early history of the colonies was therefore a tumultuous period marked by rebellion, defiance, and ingratitude. Despite the generosity of the King of Inglaterra in granting them a charter, these separatist settlers wasted no time in establishing their own laws and customs, casting aside the benevolent guidance of royal governance. The establishment of their own laws presented the colonists, however, with a problem they had not foreseen. Lifelong dissenters now found themselves charged with maintaining order and enforcing conformity. Their response was, perhaps, predictable. The Puritan leaders, claiming a divine mandate, established a strict theocracy that brooked no dissent and punished those who dared to question their religious orthodoxy. The draconian nature of their laws can be seen in the Book of the General Laws and Liberties Concerning the Inhabitants of Massachusetts, the first printed laws in the colonies, which would serve as the model for statutory law in other settlements. There, we find the following provisions. 1. If any man after legal conviction shall have or worship any other god but the Lord God, he shall be put to death. 2. If any man or woman be a witch, that is, hath or consulteth with a familiar spirit, they shall be put to death. 3. If any person shall blaspheme the name of God, the Father, Son, or Holy Ghost, with direct, express, presumptuous, or high-handed blasphemy, or shall curse God in the like manner, he shall be put to death. 4. If any man or woman shall lie with any beast or brute creature by carnal copulation, they shall surely be put to death, and the beast shall be slain and buried and not eaten. 5. If any man lieth with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed abomination, they both shall surely be put to death. 6. If any man rise up by false witness, wittingly and of purpose to take away any man's life, he shall be put to death. It is clear, even from this brief excerpt, that the legal code of the Amrikiyun was far harsher than the Sharia, where the death penalty can only be applied in the case of kisas or hudud offences, and only then under very strict conditions. We will see, in the next chapter, what terrible miscarriages of justice inevitably result from such an unforgiving and punitive regime. And that's a wrap for today's episode of Amrika. We hope you enjoyed diving into the real history of the United States with us. Before we sign off, I want to remind you to keep the conversation going. If you have thoughts, questions, or stories to share related to today's episode, we want to hear them. Drop us a line on social media or shoot us an email at dylan@amrikabook.com. And if you haven't already, don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. This way, you won't miss a single episode, and you'll always be up to date with the latest discussions and interviews. Also, your reviews mean the world to us. If you enjoyed today's episode or any others, please take a moment to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your feedback helps us grow and improve. And of course, a big thank you to all of our amazing listeners. Your support keeps us motivated to bring you engaging and thought-provoking content every week. And that's it for now. Until next time, remember to stay curious, stay inspired, and keep fighting for justice. We'll catch you in the next episode of Amrika. Stay tuned.